begin. The title of this panel is Corporate Takeover of Women's Lives, and we're delighted to be able to bring a gender focus, a clear gender focus, into the deliberations of the public eye on Davos. We have the panelists that we have brought together. To my left is Crystal Sylvia. Crystal is a social worker and a community organizer in Washington, D.C., and she worked with the D.C. Health Coalition. She's going to tell the story of a long community battle in Washington, D.C. to keep open the only public hospital in the city, which in the end was lost and was closed, and the city contract was turned over to an HMO, and that the impact that that has had on the community and on families, and particularly on women who carry the responsibility not only for their own health but for family health. Desima Williams, that we are still awaiting, comes to us from Grenada via Brandeis University. Desima will discuss the famous banana fight between U.S. corporations and the European Union in terms of their special trade agreements on bananas with their former colonies. The U.S. won the fight, and what happened is that the banana growers in the Caribbean are paying the price. And she will talk about the impact of the loss of the trade of the Caribbean bananas, many of whom were women. The women in the rural sections of the Caribbean were small agriculturalists and depended very much on the banana trade. Karen Nussbaum, to my right, directs the Working Women's Department at the AFL-CIO in Washington. Karen will give us an overview of women workers in current corporate-led global economic integration. And then the woman that we are also awaiting is a woman by the name of Sofia Emiliano. Sofia is a former worker in the Xinhuan textile factory in Guatemala. And she will tell the story of her attempts to organize that factory. The Xinhuan factory is the supplier for Gap. And I understand that AFL-CIO and Unite had a, I guess demonstration isn't the proper word, but had a meeting outside of Gap yesterday with some of the workers from different parts of the world. The panel is sponsored and coordinated by the International Gender and Trade Network, and I want to recognize my colleagues in this effort. Kathy Feingold, are you here? She's been running back and forth, and she's waiting for Sofia Emiliano downstairs. Kathy works in the global Women in the Global Economy program at AFL-CIO and is part of Karen's team. And then Farah Fosse, Farah, works for the International Gender and Trade Network in the Center of Concern. The stories that you're going to hear this afternoon, at least three of them, are very different. They tell very different stories, they're in very different settings. But there is a common thread, and the common thread is how women, families, and communities' lives are changed when a corporation moves into an area, a sector, an industry, or a public service. And the change, although sometimes it is for the better, is often for the worse. Some people and communities are affected more seriously due to their vulnerabilities. The primary vulnerability, of course, being poverty. But also lack of political clout, which of course is an effect of not being among the elite. Race and ethnicity also play a role in terms of what happens to communities when corporations move in. And we speak of race and ethnicity in the United States as our minority groups. So it's actually any of the minority groups in different countries that bear the heavy burden. And also, of course, gender. And they all work together to increase the negative impact when major corporate changes happen in a community. Women, particularly women of color, often bear the greatest burdens of the disruption. And that's because of the social roles that they play, the social expectations put upon women, and also discrimination. The social expectations have moved women in many parts of the world into what we call a double work demand. The work in the productive workforce, where they go out and they work outside the home in order to bring in necessary income for the well-being of the family. But also the woman's responsibility for social reproduction or her reproductive work, which means much more than just bearing a child. It means the entire responsibility, or the primary, if not entire, to ensure the well-being of the family and the communities in which family live. I always say that women may be unemployed, but they are never out of work. And that's the experience of women all over the world. And as I said, discrimination is the other cause why women bear the burden often very more than men. And most of this is relatively invisible. I cannot tell you how much time, effort, conversation, lobbying, writing that the members of the International Gender and Trade Network have made all over the world to try to bring women's experience into visibility. People like to say that economic issues, macroeconomic issues, are gender neutral. And we know that they are not. And the reason they're not is because of the different social roles, social expectations, and patterns of discrimination that exist between women and men. And discrimination plays a major role. That 70% of the world's poor are women, or those dependent upon women, and that's a UNDP statistic, is not an accident. It is the direct effect of discrimination and the unequal distribution of work in every society in the world. Today we will hear how women have been particularly affected due to privatization, trade rules, and employment patterns and practices. And so we'll begin with Crystal and the story of the privatization of the one public health hospital in Washington, D.C.
The corporate takeover of the planet that we're talking about today really is a race to the bottom, where we know women lose out. Women, along with men, children, elderly, all most of the people on Earth lose out. But as Maria was just pointing out, we know that women of color, particularly women in developing countries, suffer the most devastating impacts of corporate takeover. And I think women in the U.S. experience this corporate takeover a little differently, and I think just some of what I'm going to touch on is what Maria already spoke about. But just, you know, in the United States, of course, women are the primary caretakers of children. Women are also the primary caretakers of elderly relatives. Most of the people in the United States that are uninsured are women and their children. Most of those who are living in poverty are women and their children, and most public sector workers in the United States are women. So when we're talking about the privatization and the cuts in services, you can see right there how it can affect women the most. And so I'm going to be talking about DC General, and just want to talk about first is DC General was privatized, but it follows a long line of services that have been cut and eroded in DC. And I think that when you look at the IMF and World Bank policies that have been implementing, that have been implemented all across the world, you can see that the structural adjustment programs, the cuts in services and privatizations that are happening across the world are also happening in the United States. And I know that they're happening in other cities across this country, but in DC, we're experiencing them most painfully. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is that DC is majority African-American city, and two, I don't know how many people are aware of this, but in residents of Washington, DC are disenfranchised. We have no vote in Congress, no representation in Congress with full voting rights, and this really does play an important role, because Congress has to approve our budget, and they can tell us what programs can and cannot be funded. And so I think that's why you can see, if you look at statistics in D.C. there, you know, compared to other cities across the U.S., you know, that D.C. falls along the bottom in most of them. And I want to just point that out because I think that's really important. And I just want to kind of give a little picture of how the closing of D.C. General came about. In 1995, there was a financial meltdown in Washington, D.C., where the budget was out of control. There was a huge deficit. And so what happened was President Clinton and the Congress stepped in and said, well, you all don't know how to manage your finances, so we're going to do it for you. And they appointed this control board, which was unelected and usurped the powers of the mayor and the city council, and went in and started gutting social services. And so from 1995 on, we really saw the dismantling of the social safety net. And I think that was compounded by the 1996, the welfare legislation that President Clinton implemented. And so, I just want to just give one example of a program that was cut and just kind of show how women were affected in particular. In 1995, there's a program called the Chore Aid Program in Washington, D.C. that was eliminated. And what that program did was it helped senior citizens and elderly with tasks such as shopping, taking care of themselves, doing housework, that kind of thing. And it really helped those senior citizens that are elderly that were unable to afford living in a nursing home. And what happened is after this program was cut, it had a tremendous effect because, number one, we know that women make up most of the elderly population, that's one. And two, we know that most of the care for the elderly in the country fall upon women. So with that service and support taken away, that was an additional burden on the women of D.C. So I just wanted to kind of point that out. And so while these cuts were happening in Washington, D.C., the control board, the mayor, and the city council told us two things. One, that they had no choice but to cut up the programs. And two, they had a cure for us. They said that the way to solve the city's, you know, financial ills is to increase tourism and business. And they said that this will, in turn, increase the tax base. And then that once we get this money coming in, then we can, of course, spend it on improving services and restoring all those programs that they cut, right? And, you know, 7 years later, 6 years later, we're still seeing that's not being realized. And so one of the things that we've seen while the budget was balanced on the backs of the poor, one of the things that we've seen that we now have in D.C. that is completely unhelpful to the majority of D.C. residents is we have, you know, an MCI arena, which is, you know, has basketball and hockey. There's a $800 million publicly financed convention center that's being under construction right now. And we have a proposed baseball stadium and a bid for the 2012 Olympics. So that's what's on the pipeline coming out of D.C. And so we see year after year, the politicians continue to vote to increase corporate welfare while cutting services. And just to kind of look at what the health of D.C. residents is like, I just want to give a couple of statistics so I don't bog people down with numbers. D.C. has the highest rate of AIDS in the country per capita. And 1 in 6 D.C. residents lack health insurance, and most of these are women. And the infant mortality rate in D.C. is 12.5 per 1,000, which is double the national average. So it's in this context that I wanted to talk about D.C. General. I think it's really important to kind of look at it in terms of what's happening in the city. Now, D.C. General Hospital was closed in June of 2001, and it was the only hospital in D.C. that was public, and it was the only hospital that had the legal obligation to serve anyone who walked through its doors, regardless of the ability to pay, residency, immigration status. Anyone that walked in that needed a service could get service. And that was extremely, vital part of the safety net in D.C. And it was also located in the eastern half of the city, and that part of the city in particular has the highest rate of or incidents of trauma and injury in the city. And so that having a hospital right there is really important. And however, like most city services in DC, year after year, it was continually underfunded and left for disrepair. But even still, even though it was underfunded, I think it's really important to note that this public hospital had a renowned level one trauma center. And part of the reason why is that there's such trauma in that area due to accidents, injuries, a lot of them having to do with gunshot wounds, that the military actually trained doctors in DC General emergency rooms in preparation for war. So this is, you know, happening in the nation's capital, and I think that really speaks volumes about the conditions in this country. So it was a renowned level one trauma care center, and also it was rated 94% by an agency that rates hospitals in the United States, and that agency is called JCO, and that's well above the national average. So even though it was underfunded and left to disrepair, you know, the people that worked there really did the best that they could and provided services that were essential. And so one of the things I think it's important to, when you look at the effects of the hospital closing, is it doesn't just affect the patients, but it also affects the employees, right? And most of the employees of DC General were women, and most of them were unionized. So when you're closing public services, particularly DC General here, that means losing union jobs, jobs that have some stability, decent pay, and healthcare benefits, which is really important. Before I just talk about the effects of after the hospital has closed, I just wanted to look at the effects on women, you know, who were made up most of the workforce at DC General while the hospital was open. And I think this is really important because this sometimes can be an issue that we sometimes forget about. And so part of the politician's strategy in being able to implement their program of privatization is being able to kind of demonize public services, right? Say that they're wasteful, that they're inefficient. And so in DC, they talk about this culture, you know, the culture of public services. I work with DC public schools, and we also have this culture of, you know, it being inefficient and not being able to get the job done. But they talk about this culture that breeds waste and poor performance. And, you know, the politicians say that this can't be fixed and therefore has to be eliminated. And so you see with DC General Hospital, for years, the employees were continually blamed for, you know, the over budgets, some of the problems that were happening in the hospital. And, you know, basically being treated as being incompetent. And this really has both a psychological, emotional, and physical effect. It has a physical toll on people. And I think it's important to point out, because when you're working in an environment where there's a constant threat looming over you of mass layoffs, of closure, you know, you're reading in the paper about how, you know, you're not doing your job, that really is, you know, it really demoralizes. And it makes it a very hard work environment for people to live in, particularly when you also don't have the right equipment and that type of a thing. So I think that's a really important point to make because, as I said, I'm with DC Public Schools now, and we're facing a similar challenge where, you know, we see in the newspapers we're being blamed and we're being looked at as, you know, the problem rather than the city not investing in these services. And that really does takes a toll on people. And so I want to kind of move on to how the hospital became closed. And so what happened was the budget for DC General Hospital continually went over budget because it was under budgeted and underfunded. And so the politician said, well, we want to improve health care and we want to save money, and that sounds benign and nice and all that. And so what they said, well, for the answer was to close the hospital and to privatize the services, and contracting it out to a for-profit hospital. And they said that this would improve care and save the city money. And what we're seeing now after 7 months, that the exact opposite has happened. Since the doors have closed, and there's just a couple of things that are happening which people should know. It's truly been disastrous for the residents. And one of the things is that, first of all, this hospital that now takes over the services is on the tip of the city. It's kind of hard to explain if you don't know DC, but it's very far away from the community that lives right around DC General Hospital. And so it's a very, very long ride either on public transportation, which most people have to use, or even car. And so that is a challenge and a barrier in of itself. And not only that, is that to be eligible for the services, you have to meet a certain criteria now. Because before, like I said, all you needed to do was walk through the doors and you could be served. And now what you do is you go into Greater Southeast, that's the hospital, and if you want to be seen, they say, okay, you go to that room over there, and then you get interviewed to see if you're eligible. And if you're not eligible, then you have to, I don't know how much is a fee, so there's a user fee, basically. And there's a fee, and it's quite expensive. And even if you are eligible, then you have to go and wait in this extremely overcrowded emergency room to get served. So that's one effect. And the other effect is that DC, the emergency room at DC General Hospital was the second busiest in the city. And now that it's been closed, you can imagine the effect on all other emergency rooms in the city. They have to absorb all those patients. They don't just go away. And so what's happening now is that in emergency rooms, they sometimes have blackouts where if an ambulance is coming in, they'll say, you can't come because we're overcrowded. So they divert them to another hospital. Well, the blackouts in the hospitals in D.C., in the community of D.C., and even in Prince George's County, which is in Maryland, has risen dramatically. And I have some charts that were created just to show, and I know this, you can't really see this too well, but this is there's little white bars right here. Okay, first of all, okay, I'm not too good at explaining graphs here, but at the bottom here are all the different hospitals in Washington, D.C., right? And then on the side, this side, are the hours of closure, blackouts, right? So this white bar reflects the blackouts in 2000, and the red bar reflects the blackouts in 2001. And you can see the dramatic rise. And this really, I mean, when these blackouts happen, this means that ambulances have to travel further. And we've heard stories that ambulances go to one hospital, are told that they can't get service there, the patient can't get service there, so they have to travel another one. And we know that oftentimes when someone is in ambulance, particularly if they're suffering from something like a heart attack or a serious injury, that life and death, you know, depends on minutes, and that this, you can't just travel around to different hospitals. So that has been one of the biggest effects, of the hospital closure. And I think the other thing that's happening is this: just recently, the city council in D.C. said, well, let's review how this plan is going. Let's see if healthcare has improved or what's going on. And they had a city council hearing on January 15th. And what Ivan Walks, who is the city's health director, said is, well, we've enrolled, this many people. And one of the things that he said is that, less people are seeking services. And he seems to look at that as a good thing. Like, oh, somehow suddenly people are, healthier. And that means that people are getting more preventive care, so they don't have to go to the hospital and all that other stuff. And I think it's very similar to what you saw around the welfare, the welfare legislation that was implemented when Clinton was in office, where the roles of welfare dramatically dropped by half and maybe even more in some places. And then everyone was saying that, women were suddenly, wealthy, or they had these good paying jobs and maybe, could afford decent housing and that kind of thing. And it's completely outrageous. The opposite is happening. People are not getting the health care. People are not, getting the basic necessities to survive. And so it's really cynical when politicians use this, to tout their programs. So that's basically a picture of kind of what's happened with DC General in terms of the effects. It's hard to know because there was a gag order on the emergency, that the ambulance drivers. We weren't even allowed to interview them. They were told that they were ordered not to talk because they knew that the evidence was damaging. So what we've been able to do is just by going and, you know, interviewing people and talking with the community and just one, how much time do I need? Okay. So I'm sorry, I've talked way over, so I guess I'll just end there and see if people have questions after. Sorry.
Thank you. I think that's a very powerful story when you put it in the context that it is in the national capital of the wealthiest nation in the world, and a nation that houses many of the corporations that are in the city today. So now we're going to, unfortunately, Desima has not arrived. I have no knowledge why. So the Grenada story will wait for a while. Hopefully she will arrive. And turn the mic to Karen Nussbaum of AFL-CIO, who will talk about employment patterns and corporate patterns.
Thank you, Maria, and thank you, Crystal, for a wonderful, terrible, but very illuminating story. I want to just start with a word about unions. The AFL-CIO here in the United States has 13 million members. 40%, about 5.5 million, are women, which makes us the largest women's organization in the country by a factor of about 100 or something. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if you hadn't thought about the AFL-CIO as the largest, most powerful advocate for women in the country until recently, but that is how we see our mission since John Sweeney became the president 6 years ago. And I think that's part of the story of unions. How do we take the power of unions and really put them in the service of women and women workers? The AFL-CIO is part of a world federation, which you wouldn't even want to know the name of, which has hundreds of millions of members coming from 143 countries, and again, 40% of those members are women. The unions around the globe that are part of the World Federation, which is called the ICFTU, International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, has a terrible challenge, and that is to operate really as global unions. And it's a challenge that we are struggling hard to take up, and our success, everything depends on our success, we feel in a way. I wanted to tell you about a visit last November I took to Ciudad Juarez in Mexico, where I saw what free trade and corporate investment has meant to women there. Millions of people have flooded into Juarez to work in the export processing zone there. And Ciudad Juarez now dwarfs El Paso, which is its sister city across the border. Women and girls get jobs in the apparel and electronics plants, but these companies have remained totally silent while hundreds of girls and young women have been raped and murdered over the last 2 years, usually on their way to and from work. One girl disappeared because she arrived 2 minutes late to work in the morning, and the plant locked the gates and would not let her in, despite the fact that she pounded on the doors. It meant that she was left alone and isolated and exposed to make her way home, which she never did. She never got home. With the recession, these plants are closing and the jobs are leaving Juarez, most of them gone for good. Union organizers there told us that it is even harder to organize workers now around issues like pay and health and safety and violence, because the companies there now then have the opportunity to blame the unions for the plants having to close down and driving the jobs away. And these are jobs that the manufacturers intend to move anyway to lower wage countries like Vietnam or China. On the day I arrived in Juarez, the remains of 8 more women were found in a vacant lot on a busy corner in the middle of the intersection of the 2 busiest streets in Juarez. The lot is directly across the street from the Maquiladora Association headquarters, a huge multi-story building. While these eight recent, the bodies of the eight women that were found recently have stirred again protest in the city by women's advocates and unions, still it's a very hard struggle to fight, partly because there are no resources in the city and the government to take up the investigation, even if there were the political will. Now, these stories are stark, but they're similar to ones I've heard in the Philippines, for example, where hundreds of thousands of women work in export processing zones there, often living in hostels where six women share a small bedroom and 140 women share three toilets. Or in Bangladesh, where teenagers work 20-hour shifts and live in hovels on stilts over fetid water. Well, if this is development, it's not good enough. There are 27 million workers in EPZs, export processing zones. 90% of them are women. There are many millions more who work in informal work in the informal economy, very often feeding the manufacturers in those countries. Now, these corporations who set up this system of work operate on a principle. And the principle, as they would tell you, is to maximize profits. And it involves a necessary set of consequences. And as corporations shift where to manufacture goods to find ever lower wages, it's not just the woman in Cleveland who has lost her job making Mr. Coffee machines to a woman in Mexico, which happened just 2 years ago. But it's also now the woman in Mexico who's losing her job to a woman in China. Well, we, broadly speaking, operate on a principle too, and that is that the global economy has to work for working families around the globe, that the economy should work for people and not the other way around. Now, the global policies affect women in a lot of ways, including privatization that we heard about from Crystal, but there are a few others that I want to briefly touch on, really very briefly. One is decreasing government spending for services which benefit women and their families. Crystal talked a bit about that as well, but for example, in Zimbabwe, where health care and education had been free, the World Bank decided that these services should no longer be free and that they were now free services for cost. And in the year after the World Bank forced the implementation of these policies, the number of women who died in childbirth doubled. The policies result in reducing real wages. In Mexico, wages have fallen 15 to 20% since NAFTA took effect. We've heard about privatization in the U.S., but in Argentina, not only have pensions and healthcare been privatized, but they even privatized the zoo. And the new owners sold off the exotic animals. They also weaken the rights of women and working women and men. And EPZs are just one example where typically unionizing or organizing in any form is outlawed, prohibited by law. Now, women like Sophia, who we will hear from momentarily, are building the muscle. Back up just a moment, but just as women have fueled the expansion of the global economy, they are increasingly becoming the leaders for change. And women like Sophia are building the muscle that pit workers' rights against corporate rights. In the U.S., women are the most likely sector of the workforce to organize, and that's been true for 20 years now. And just in this last year, 92,000 new women joined the workforce, and nearly half of those actually were Latinas. Organizing in unions, in informal worker organizations, and a combination of the two is also going on around the world. The heart of this effort is a unified call from unions in every country to implement the International Labor Organization, the ILO, Declaration of Fundamental Principles and Rights. This is important because the ILO is a tripartite body. It's business, it's unions, and it's governments. And this declaration is one that every single nation has signed on to. And it establishes core labor rights, No child labor, no forced labor, an end to discrimination, and the right to organize, the freedom of association. These are fundamental rights. With these rights, you could have the power to have a voice in your country over labor policies. Now, this is not the same as the many conventions that the ILO passes, also, which are also extremely important. Conventions like the Maternity Leave Convention that just passed about a year or two ago. But I make this point to say that we're not talking about establishing a single standard around the globe. We're not saying that there should be one minimum wage, but instead that workers around the globe should have the basic rights to have a voice in their country. We see core labor rights as an essential strategy, but only one strategy. In the US, the AFL-CIO is also fighting for cancellation of debt, increased development aid, fair trade policies, and reform of the IMF and World Bank. We are committed to this as a long-term struggle, because if we don't win on these terms, then we won't win at all. And we fight for these rights and this framework, not just at the bargaining table, but in Seattle, in Doha, and here in New York. We have to build global unions, as I talked about earlier, and we have to, and it's going to take an enormous period of experimentation and failure and finally success. Finally, in 1995, at the UN Women's Conference in Beijing, women established that women's rights are not a special category, but they're human rights. And similarly, in today's world, where most women work for pay, women need their rights as workers. Women cannot achieve full standing as human beings in this world unless they also have full standing as workers. So workers' rights are women's rights. And I believe with this framework, with these principles, we will rewrite the rules for a new economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. And I want to welcome Sophia
and your translator, who is?
Welcome to Laura also. Sophia is going to put a very human face on the ideas that Karen brought forward to us in terms of her struggle as a Guatemalan factory worker.
Buenas tardes, yo vengo de Guatemala. Soy una trabajadora. Anteriormente trabajé en varias maquilas, pero viendo la necesidad, la situación que pasan las compañeras en esos lugares, yo un día dije, ¿quién va a hablar? Dije, si todas tienen miedo porque todas son de pocos recursos económicos. Entonces,
good afternoon. My name is Sofia Sasso and I come from Guatemala. I worked for several years in maquila factories, and after I stopped working in maquila factories, I asked myself, who's going to speak for these workers?
La mayoría de personas somos de pocos recursos económicos. Tienen miedo de que si ellas, el maltrato y todo eso, ellas vienen a... se organizan o algo para luchar por sus derechos, les cortan el trabajo. Entonces,
most of the women working in maquila factories have few resources. They're poor, and so they have a lot of fear that if they try to fight for their rights and organize in unions, they'll lose their jobs.
Uno de los maltratos que ellas reciben en las maquilas son el trabajo es duro. Las horas extras son obligadas, las metas son demasiado altas y los sueldos bajos.
Among other things, women working in the maquila deal with mistreatment, including very, very hard work, forced overtime, production goals that simply aren't achievable.
La mayoría de personas viven en asentamientos. son madres solteras, entonces tienen la necesidad de dejar a sus hijos solos.
Another one of the mistreatments that workers deal with is extremely low salaries. The majority of workers are single mothers. They live in squatter settlements, and due to the fact that they don't make any money and can't pay for childcare, they have to leave their children at home alone while they go to work.
Ellas tienen la necesidad porque ahí han ido ellas y por lo menos dicen ellas, yo gano para el pan de mis hijos. Pero, bueno, yo creo que con el tiempo que ellas trabajan ahí, deberían de ganar para más.
When women come to work, they say, I work so that I can feed my children. But it seems to me, given how much they work and how hard they work, they should earn a little more than that.
Entonces ellas, si uno les habla de un sindicato, ellas dicen no, porque me van a quitar el trabajo. Los empresarios las intimidan porque les dicen que eso es malo, que si el sindicato las va a ayudar, que si las va a, les va a dar dinero, o que ellos están dando trabajo.
So when we go to talk to women about joining a union, they say no, they're going to take my job away from me. The empresarios, the people who own the maquila factories, corroborate this. They say, what is the sindicato going to get you? What is the union going to give you? We give you work.
Entonces, yo un día me cansé, porque entre más trabajaba, más querían. Yo ya tenía más experiencia. Entonces, dije yo, no, yo ya no quiero trabajar aquí. Aunque sea, me voy a vender tomates al mercado, pero ya no quiero trabajar aquí.
One day, I was simply exhausted. The more I worked, the more they wanted from me. The more skill I had, the more they wanted from me. And finally I said, I don't care what it takes, I'm not working here anymore. If I have to go sell tomatoes in the market, I'll sell tomatoes in the market.
Renuncié a mi trabajo. Tenía necesidad, pero al fin se cansa uno. Entonces me hablaron de Festras, de la organización, y yo a un compañero le dije que me consiguiera trabajo ahí, que me interesaba trabajar ahí.
So one day I quit, I resigned. I did need a job, I did need money, but I simply couldn't take it anymore. That's when I heard about this job at Festras, the union federation that represents the union that she's organizing.
Entonces, él un día llegó y me dijo, fíjese que ya le encontré la entrevista. Entonces, yo le dije que estaba bien. Fui a solicitar el trabajo y me lo dieron.
So a friend of hers told her about this job available at Festras, and he said, you know, I can get you an interview. So she went to get the interview and was able to begin work at Festras as a union organizer.
Luego empecé. Yo creo que empecé con más lucha, porque tenemos que ir a visitar a otras compañeras a sus casas para deber de decirles que ¿qué es lo bueno del sindicato? ¿Qué es lo bueno de organizarse?
So I started, and that's when I started in the struggle. And it was hard at first. We had to visit our compañeras, our fellow workers in their houses, to explain to them what the union was and why it would be good for them to join it, to organize themselves.
Estas personas necesitan de mucha capacidad porque son muy humildes y entienden muy poco del sindicato. Tienen mucho miedo y dicen que los que hacen sindicatos solo cosas malas hacen y que las pueden mandar a matar, que las secuestran, porque en Guatemala así es. A un sindicalista siempre lo mandan a secuestrar porque no quieren que hagan cosas buenas, seguramente.
It took a lot of time to educate people because most people just don't know what a union is. They lack education about unions. Furthermore, they're very scared when they hear about unions. They hear things like, union members get kidnapped, union members get killed, because this does happen in Guatemala. In Guatemala, union members do get kidnapped and they do get killed.
Luego yo me arriesgo porque digo yo, bueno, pero para deber de ayudar a mis compañeras, pues tengo que hacerlo. Entonces empezamos. Hemos empezado con esa lucha y ya hay dos sindicatos en dos maquilas.
But I decided to take the risk because I wanted to help my compañeras, my fellow workers. So we started the struggle, and now we've achieved it. There are two maquila unions in Guatemala.
Pero sin embargo, aún está difícil la situación porque hay, el empresario ha mandado a intimidar mucho a las personas que están afiliadas al sindicato.
Nonetheless, it's still hard. The factory owners have the factory owners have made a lot of effort to intimidate people who are joining the union.
Estamos ahorita luchando con esta etapa de que las personas que hayan más afiliados, pero nos cuesta mucho. Tenemos que caminar muchos lugares para deber de encontrarlas y que a las personas que trabajan, porque enfrente de la fábrica no podemos nosotros platicarles.
So right now we're fighting this stage of intimidation. We're working on swelling the ranks of our union, on getting more people to affiliate, which requires that we walk long distances because we just can't, it's not safe to talk about the union in front of the factory right there out in front.
Y luego nosotros les platicamos de lo que realmente es el sindicato, les hacemos que hagan conciencia de que si ellas callan, de que si ellas no se organizan, entonces ¿cuándo ellas van a vivir una vida mejor con la prenda que ellas hacen, que les paguen mejor?
So we tell them about the union, we talk with them about the union. We tell them that if they continue to stay silent, if they don't organize themselves, what chance do they have for improving their lives?
Porque en realidad lo que el empresario llega a hacer ahí, como que fuéramos esclavos, ellos nos tratan para poder que nosotros saquemos suficiente trabajo, pero es poco lo que ganamos.
Because the reality is that they treat us like slaves. They push us hard to get out to produce what they want.
Y es por eso que estamos aquí. Ahí se hace la prenda del Gap, se hace de Luis Claybor, se hace del Polo. Entonces creo que esta es una denuncia para que ellos hagan conciencia y que ellos se responsabilicen por todo esto que está pasando allá.
So that's why we're here. There we make Gap clothes, we make Liz Claiborne clothes, we make Polo. So in a sense, this is an announcement to the world, a demand that they take responsibility for how things are there. It's a great pleasure to be here with you all, and I thank you.
Very different stories, but common threads. Before we open the mic for conversation with all of you, I want to ask if anyone on the panel would like to pick up anything and comment on it. Okay, we have a mic, and I ask that you go to the mic so that we can clearly hear your question or observation, and just line up and we'll try and move as quickly. You might introduce yourself, and I think I didn't introduce myself. I'm Maria Riley from the Center of Concern in Washington, D.C.
Hi, I'm Jennifer, and I live here in New York. And when talking about labor, I think one of the points that always hits home to me is that these global corporations can move capital all over the place and switch their factories to other countries, but the workers don't have those same choices because of very strict immigration laws. And I mean that a human person doesn't have the choice to go to another country if the wages are better there. But the corporations are given all the benefits to move to places that make their products cheaper. And then also this situation of immigration also has a big impact on women. I've seen places in New York on a Sunday night, especially the places where you make international phone calls, and they're filled with men who have immigrated here for jobs, calling their wives and their children or their nieces and nephews, because a lot of the men have left to come to the richer countries, and they leave women behind with the children and left behind, sometimes sending money, but then sometimes not as dependable. So it also leaves a very difficult situation for women, I know, in countries where a lot of the men are leaving to find work. And that puts even more pressure in communities which are already under pressure and poverty. And I also just wanted to thank all the speakers who contributed.
Let me just reinforce your comment about immigration with two comments. One is that in the U.S., the union movement is fighting very hard for immigration reform. We believe that all workers should have rights as workers in this country, regardless of their immigration status. And it's something that's become a high priority for the U.S. labor movement. While it's true that most workers can't travel to another country to find a better job, still many workers do, and not just men who come north to this country, but for example, in the Philippines, millions of women are the larger number of migrant workers, leave their country often for 10 years. And you've got women who become nurses or, in this country, for example, or domestics or entertainment workers in Saudi Arabia or other countries, leaving an entire generation of children motherless. And we have to wonder what that's going to mean for those children as they reach maturity in the Philippines. And the Philippines is only one example.
Thank you to all the women on the panel and all the women in the room. Many of us are learning to appreciate your leadership. I'm Zul. This is directed to Crystal's talk, but a question open to any of you. In the 1960s and 70s, the New York City administration had a deliberate but discreet public policy of what is now known as planned shrinkage and redlining. So just at a time when our communities were changing in Central Brooklyn and Bronx, South Bronx, and in Harlem, and those communities needed more public services rather than less, was a deliberate policy to have less services. Do you see that in DC? Is there help in the media, from investigative journalists down there? Are there folks working with you that can go and look and find these documents? So there were documents found, I think, by Rod Wallace here in New York in the 80s, going back to the 60s, showing that this was in fact the case, that that those communities that most needed service.
Well, it is not new, but the trafficking in people, and when I say trafficking in people, it's primarily women and children, including girl children and boy children, for not only sex purposes, but for sweatshop purposes and for basic, bonded servants in homes, as well as arranged marriages. It is the third largest illegal trafficking in the world, behind drug trafficking and illegal trafficking in arms. It's about a $9 billion industry, and by and large, it's pretty well winked at by politicians and immigration people and border patrols. And there's a direct corollary that can be developed between the trafficking, particularly in women, but the trafficking in children too, and poverty. When families are so desperate that their choices are reduced to allowing themselves to be trafficked or to traffic their children, you know how desperate the poverty is. There's another element of it. Very often, families and women are not told the truth. They are told that they are being given legitimate jobs in the countries that they will go to, that they will maintain their passports, and that they will be able to live as free citizens. And that isn't what happens to them once they turn themselves over to the traffickers.
couple of questions. The first question has to do something that has been on my mind for some time, and that's the whole issue of making one of the core labor rights to be free speech in the workplace. This is the fourth time I've heard about gag rules of workers in their workplace. And it continues. The first time was workers in chemical plants in Louisiana who were told by management, when you cross this threshold, you lose your civil rights. And it's always been in the back of my mind and in my heart, I guess. But why, and I'm not challenging you, I'm just asking a question here. Why doesn't the labor movement take up free speech in the workplace as one of its core labor rights? And this is, I mean, I've even heard workers in Central Park now who are gagged by the Central Park Conservancy from talking about all the fencing in the park. And now I hear about these workers, the ambulance workers in Washington. And it just seems to me to be such a core belief. And it also contradicts the whole idea of the corporation as a person who has free speech rights, when in fact, the free speech of corporations isn't free at all. It's based on profit-making, you know, manipulation for profit-making. It has nothing to do with free speech. So that's my first question. Second question is for Sylvia. Thank you for coming. Do you think, have the unions been able to make the women's lives better? And how? And do you feel that you have been empowered as women together? Because, and also the whole contradiction that the previous speaker raised, the contradiction between, there are a lot of calls for boycotts in this country and in Western countries from certain movements, of boycotts of the Gap and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But the contradiction there is in terms of people working at these places need the jobs. So maybe it would be better if the boycotts also said, we're boycotting to put pressure on Liz Claiborne and the Gap to improve their working conditions for the workers. And part of where I'm coming from now, and I'd like all the panel to address this, as well as every woman in this room, do you think that, because you talked about the AFL-CIO, 40% of all their old workers, and that's the biggest women's organization in the world. Do you have a feminist perspective on that statement? I mean, do you consider yourself? I mean, I'm at the point now. I mean,
I've been in the women's movement since 1972.
I'm not pulling that. I don't care about that. What I really care about is what if progressive women made their priority? What if we said we were women's liberationists first and progressives second? I think. We'd have a different. I think there'd be different perspectives on that. And do you all think about those things? And what are the challenges that you face in terms of that? Because none of you have really talked about organizing women as women, in with a feminist or women's liberationist perspective.
Translate them just pretty straightforwardly. The first one is, has the union movement helped women?
Yes.
Or has this union helped women, and how?
And do women feel more empowered?
And do women feel more empowered? And then what is your feeling about boycotts as a means of pressuring, if this is effective, or if it just ends up having people lose their jobs?
There are contradictions of saying, let's boycott the Gap. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But there's a contradiction there.
Las mujeres a través del sindicato, ellas sienten como más esperanza de que ellas van a tener un trato mejor dentro de la maquila, que ellas, es de mucha lucha, pero ellas sí creen que sí están consiguiendo algo, que es poco lo que han conseguido por el momento, pero es muy importante el que las dejen ir al baño libremente.
She said, I think that one of the things that women have gained through the union is hope that things can change for the better. It's been a hard fight to get better treatment. It's been a long struggle, and it may be small, the gains that we've made, but they're important. One example being the freedom to go to the bathroom while we're at work, as an example.
ellas, el poder que ellas tienen, pues la mayoría es de tal vez movilizarse dentro de la fábrica mejor.
And as far as empowerment goes, one kind of power they've gained is the ability to mobilize themselves inside the factory.
De que dejen de comprar no sería buena para nosotros, porque entonces no habría trabajo. Lo único que pedimos es que presionen a que el código de conducta que dicen que tienen que tener en las fábricas sí lo cumplan.
In reality, a boycott, ceasing to buy Les Claiborne clothing, wouldn't help us because then we would just lose our jobs. What we do want, the only thing we ask for, is that you pressure companies like Les Claiborne so that they follow through with their codes of conduct.
Let me briefly comment on the issue of free speech. We have among the worst labor laws in the world. In this country, you don't have ipso facto. When you walk in the door, you lose your right to free speech, you lose the right to freedom of assembly, and many other basic rights. And in fact, it's only through a union that many of those rights are protected at all. But in fact, our union, the laws that cover the right to organize only cover half of all workers in this country, and that half wishes they didn't. The laws are terrible and, in fact, largely work to the benefit to constrain workers in pursuing their rights rather than empower them. And that's why we actually are experimenting in some places with following the codes of the core labor rights instead of the actual labor laws in this country, and instead of using the National Labor Relations Board to adjudicate, instead setting up community panels to force companies to abide by community standards of what's fair for workers. That's happening here in New York and in other communities as well. So I think that it's something that we're aware of. And on the issue of feminism in the labor movement, many of us are in the labor movement and are feminists. I do this work because I've seen women transformed by unions, and I've seen unions transformed by women every single day.
Sitting next to you, and I spend probably 80% of our time organizing women globally around gender and trade issues. As women struggling with and for women, for women's rights.
Hi, I'm Gail. I'm a graduate student from the University of Michigan studying international public policy. And my question is to the speaker from AFL-CIO. And it's concerning the ILO. I know, you know, a lot of people feel the major weakness of the ILO is that it doesn't have an enforcement mechanism. A lot of countries would state that they are following the ILO standards. So I'd just like to hear you speak on how you would go about getting the ILO to have more teeth and whether or not tying it to trade rules would be a feasible option, specifically the WTO.
Yes, we believe that both strategies should be pursued, that the ILO does need to be strengthened, does need to be have more, carry serious weight and have the ability to enforce some of its standards, but that we should also be linking labor rights and environmental rights with trade policy.
My name is Amber Simcoe, and I'm at the University of Michigan studying environmental policy. And I lost my voice last week, so I apologize for that. It leads right into what you were saying about environmental laws. My question was specifically, I've noticed that like a lot of economists, they'll say, well, these women are working the job that's best available to them. Working for a dollar a day is infinitely better than not having a job at all. But frequently there's a chance that their resources have been polluted or taken away or privatized to the point where they can't even use them to sustain themselves. And I was just wondering if Sophia could maybe tell us a little bit about what life was like before the factory came and kind of why women still choose to go there even when their rights are being denied.
La mayoría de personas trabajaban en el campo. Bueno, yo creo que uno trabajar en el campo creo que tiene más comida. Porque ahí uno lo cosecha y no tiene que comprarlo.
Before the Miquilas came to Guatemala, most people worked in the campo, in the fields. And it seems to me that people had more food then, because where they worked was where they could harvest their food as well. And they didn't have to buy it.
Por lo que ellas, la mayoría es que, bueno, ya se viste, se puede uno vestir un poco mejor. Pueden, tal vez es una facilidad para tener a sus hijos en los estudiando, ya que hay mucha madre soltera.
Now though, it seems that people might be able to dress a little bit better, and it might be easier for their children to study now.
Porque en realidad tienen mucha necesidad y ellos dicen que por lo menos ganan para un pan de sus hijos. Pero sí hay muchas personas que dicen, bueno, yo quisiera dejar el trabajo, pero a veces ellas ya se sienten con mucho compromiso de que con la esperanza del dinero que están ganando, a veces hasta un terreno o algo están ellas abonando. Entonces eso es lo que ellas piensan, que ya no van a poder hacerlo.
And with respect to the question about why people continue to work in a maquila if the treatment is so bad, it's out of need. She said again, that we work for the bread of our children, to give our children what to eat. After a while as well, one might say, well, I'd like to leave the maquila, but one has already committed one's hopes to things like buying a little piece of land, in gaining money, and so with those plans in mind, to leave work just doesn't seem feasible.
I'd also like to make the observation, because I've heard this argument before, just because people are in need is not an excuse for exploiting their labor. And, you know, that's a very, very questionable argument, that we can pay them as little as we want because they need so much. That's sheer exploitation.
Hi, this question is, my name is Ariana Martinez. I'm a student at SUNY Purchase in Westchester. My question is for the woman from the AFL-CIO. I realize that someone brought up the issue of sex trafficking. I wanted to address more just the issue of prostitution in this country and globally. I look at it as a union issue, and I was just wondering if your organization or you personally have an opinion on that.
I actually don't know if our organization has an opinion. I think that we think about it, and that there is some distinction to be made between people who are sex workers and others who are trafficked for sex or who are against their will performing this kind of work. In fact, there's a union of exotic dancers in San Francisco, part of my home union, the Service Employees International Union. And so these are, that there's the belief that people who choose to do work, and I know there's a question about choice here that's extremely profound, should have the ability to have some rights. And I also think that there's a big difference between exotic dancers and prostitution. I think it's a big issue. It's not one that we have a firm position on, but I think that the solution is not, that you can't just ban prostitution without providing jobs, which is generally why people go into it. And so I think it's very complex and it needs a real holistic approach.
I just wanted to say one thing too, because as I said before, I'm a social worker and I work with DC Public Schools now, but before that, for 5 years, I worked with homeless women in DC, and a lot of them were substance abusers, and a lot of them also prostituted themselves to support their drug habit. And I think it comes down to a number of issues, but one of them, in terms of when you're talking about health, it really is a health issue, because when and with so many of the women that I worked with, obviously they did not want to do it. They were ashamed of what they had forced themselves to do, and they needed a lot of them had very traumatic childhood lives. Once they started using drugs to kind of cope with these things, you know, if this country and actually all over the world, if they really had any kind of real mental health system to help people with different types of traumas and stuff like that, then maybe people could have more choices. And I think this is just one type of, you know, prostitution, but I think a lot of it has to do with health issues. And I know that I would sometimes get clients calling me from the jail, calling me saying, you know, when I get out, I want to get into rehab. Can you help me get into rehab? Because I know if I'm out on the street, I'm going to relapse, and then relapse turns to you obviously using drugs and prostituting. And I literally would have to call around, and I could, you know, so many times I could not find any services for women. And so I think there's a lot of issues involved, and I think that's really important.
Hi, my name is Hester Betlem. I don't really have a question, but I can resist a whole bunch of activists in a room. I work with an organization called Witness, and basically we provide video cameras to NGOs around the world. And we're currently working on a project, a documentary that's already been finished. It's called Behind the Labels, in cooperation with Tia Lesson. And it's about sweatshops in Saipan. And what we're trying to do right now, it's very relevant to women's issues and of course labor issues. What we're trying to do now is get as many organizations involved to try to screen this documentary film. It's an extremely good learning tool. And I just wanted to let everybody know that it's out there. I'll be sitting right here on the left side corner. So if anybody's interested, I have the information.
Hi, my name is Pauline Muchina. I'm from Kenya and I live here in New York. And I was listening to the last two speeches. Unfortunately, I missed the first one. And I just want to thank the speakers who spoke and just to raise issues that I've been wrestling with and just want to throw them out here to see how we as activists, you know, trying to stand in solidarity with women throughout the world can do it a little bit better, because I believe that discrimination against women or the conditions of women in maquiladoras or any companies that operates in these third world countries are tolerated where discrimination of women is allowed. In, for example, like in Kenya, where I come from, you know, if women are discriminated against, you know, what will help if they go to a company and the company discriminate against them? Where else can they go? The police, they can't turn to the police. They can't turn to their churches or religious institutions that are also discriminating against them. They can't turn to their families because their families also discriminate them. So I think as activists, we really need to empower women, you know, so that they are not discriminated against anywhere within the societies. So that when they get to these companies, they will not be tolerated. I mean, they will not be discriminated against either. And I think there is also an important point that we need to look into. That is, you know, in countries where governments are corrupt and they are treating their workers the same way these companies are treating their workers, they are not going to say anything when these companies come into our countries and start, you know, behaving the way they behave. So if we really want to change those situations, then we have to fight for democracy in these countries and the right for speech. If people can't have free speech in countries, well, how do you expect them to have free speech in companies that operate in the same countries? So I think all these things are linked, and we have to tie them together as we fight for the freedom of women to work freely and to be paid freely, and you know, to have all their basic human rights, not only when they are working for these corporations, but also when they are in their homes, in their churches, wherever they are, in schools, even in schools, you know, because that's where we begin, by empowering women to stand for their rights, and then we stand with them and see how we can challenge these corporations. Because I think, you know, I might be wrong, but you know, you can correct me, that a lot of people who make decisions in these companies are men, you know, and so they are, you know, how are they going to be sympathetic to women if it is the same men who discriminate against us in other circumstances? So we really need to make those connections and fight for our rights. Thank you.
I guess I wanted to bounce off of a point that you had been making, which was the sort of the conditions of desperation that are created, which force women people into jobs that that aren't good for them. And I think one of the things, what it brings to me is that there's a piece missing here, which is about services and social services. I don't think that it's a coincidence that, and in the time of our tightest labor market, we were also attacking our social safety net. And that if you look at the World Trade Agenda, there is an agenda of attacking social safety nets in countries across the world. And so I think when we talk about women in the labor movement, we have to put the social safety net front and center as a labor movement issue. I also think that there are a whole set of other social services that are so important for women in the workforce that again, we need to make it part of our agenda: child care, health care, education for children, which are just crucial for women as working actors. And I think bouncing from that to the last speaker's point is the need for us to actually have an agenda of getting women elected and in politically active roles to make those types of changes happen.
My name is Jane. I'm a student at Columbia University. I have actually a comment and a question to follow up with a comment. Following up with what the participant from Kenya said, I think a lot of women are very frustrated by how disempowered we are all around the world. And I think rather than channeling that anger towards, getting into a frenzy and getting very angry, I think activism is a good way to really channel our anger. And the thing that really bothers me the most is sex trafficking, you know, of women around the world. And I'd like to know if you know of any organizations that are very, very much at the forefront of dealing or combating sex trafficking, and how one can start participating or becoming an active in these organizations.
I just got a book this week that I did not have time to look at, but it's about human rights and trafficking, and its focus is on women. And if you give me your email, I will send you the information, because it is about organizations that are focusing on this. I just didn't get to it this week.
Okay. Thank you.
So if you give me your information, I will send that information to you.
Okay. I just wanted to make a comment just on one of the things that the speaker said was just in terms of empowering women, and I think for them to become activists in their communities. And I think one of the things that I had left out, unfortunately, was talking about, I mean, I said the story was you know, rather depressing if you look at it with what happened with DC General, but I want to let people know, first of all, that the fight's not over, but more importantly, that women played a crucial role in the fight to save the hospital, and that probably, you know, came about because most of the workers were women, and also, you know, most of the people that are affected by the hospital closing are women. But just a couple of things. There were two women, one of them being a hospital worker, and then one of them just who was a community activist that was actually, who's involved with global justice movement stuff, went on a hunger fast. And so they really put themselves on the line in that way. And even with the DC Healthcare Coalition, we're primarily made up of women. And I think that so many times when you look at the world today and you see the horrible conditions that women face, you know, you can just kind of look at women as victims. And I think it's really important that we can see not just, you know, the DC General is just one example, but in many struggles around the world with what Sophia is doing, that women are part of the resistance. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. So I wanted to make sure that we had a, you know, a positive end, because I know we're not done yet, but just that we come away knowing that women are empowering themselves and have empowered themselves to be part of that resistance, which I think is important.
Thank you. That's a wonderful closing.